Simple Action Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David and I'm an alcoholic. By way of housekeeping, we will only be recording and publishing the audio portion of this meeting. So I always mention that. I don't want anybody to be unsettled by the recording button. Nobody's video is going to end up on, I don't know, the YouTube or whatever. We just capture the audio. And also, I'm going to throw a link in the chat. You can sign up for a low volume email list at our website, simpleactions.net. And you'll also find the PayPal link. Simple Actions is observing the seventh tradition virtually. We'll talk more about that at the end of the meeting. That is all the housekeeping I have to offer. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Anybody? Feel free to unmute and say hello. Hello, BJ. Welcome.
My name's Matthew and I'm alcoholic.
Matthew, welcome.
10 days a day.
All right. Glad you're here. All righty. I wonder if Leanne would read the preamble if I post it on the screen.
My name's Leanne. I'm an alcoholic. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Leanne. So the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. So this evening, we are discussing step 4, part 2. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Arisa B. and Mike. All right. So we're not going to read you to death, but I'm going to throw up the first paragraph and then the panel will share for a few minutes on each one. We do ladies' choice around here, Arisa. You can go first or kick it to Mike after I read. So we're going to start on page 67. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and his wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause trouble. Your option, Arisa.
Why don't I go second? Mike, go ahead.
Mikey.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
My sobriety date is January 7th, 2008. I have a home group. It's 49th Street Living Sober. We got real creative with that name. It's on 49th Street. It's down by ODU, 5:30 on Thursday. So if you want to stop in before you get home from work, please do. And I have a sponsor. Fear. Fear. I was checking it out. Fear is like, to me, it's an emotion or that helps us, that alerts us to something, you know, like if you're afraid of the dark or you're afraid to go swimming, afraid of the dark, when you walk in the room, you turn a light on, you're afraid to go swimming, you don't go out deep in the ocean. That's what normal people do, you know, have a couple fears, everything's cool. Well, I found out not with me being an alcoholic. And I didn't know this at first. I was afraid of everything. And I will get to that, of how I was afraid of everything. I used fear in a lot of crazy ways. When I was a teenager, I knew I was afraid of everything. I did not speak back to my parents. They were just right. That's how it was. I didn't say anything to them. I didn't speak back to my teachers. You know, if I had a question, I was the kid who, I did okay in school, but I was the kid who waited for somebody else to ask the question. I'm not raising my hand for anything. Forget that. fear of speaking to girls, you can forget that. That was never, ever, ever going to happen. There was guys and there were girls, and I wasn't talking to half the population because I was scared to death of what, you know, they'd laugh at me. I was goofy, what I look like, what I sound like. Wasn't going to happen. Then in my senior year of high school, I found it. I found that magic liquid that we all love so much. And it's in the big book, and it says, you know, if you had told me when I was drinking that I was afraid of anything, I would have laughed in your face. And I would have. I was afraid of nothing. And I looked back. See, I'll start with this. When I share stuff, I've been here a while, and I sometimes I forget to go back because there's people new that are listening. I didn't know this when I first started. I didn't know that I was afraid of everything. I didn't know that the alcohol cured all these fears. This is just comes with time. So if you're new and you hear some crazy stuff, just hang with it. But you know, when I look back now, the reason I think I wasn't afraid of anything is because there were no consequences. None at all. None. I got arrested twice and nothing happened. But normal people don't get arrested. I got a DUI and I got a drunk in public. They were both on major holidays. I didn't stay in jail long. Nothing happened. Zero. Nothing. I went bankrupt once. You know, I'm never going to have money again. Yes, I did. I had credit cards within a year. You know, when you go bankrupt, credit card companies love you. They're going to fill you up with credit cards because you think you're going to jack them right back up again. I had no fear. I'm like, sure, I got this. I will say this part of what I'm going to say now is I was a real ass when I was drinking, and some things I'm going to say tonight are going to sound like I was a real ass, but that's part of my story, especially when we get to the sex part. And this is kind of like that. I got divorced and I had no fear of being alone because I was with somebody else already. You know, that's terrible. But that's how it was. You know, there was no consequence, none, in getting divorced. I was just moved on. And I don't mean to sound flippant with that. It's just what happened. You know, so I had no consequences. Nothing could scare me. You know, it didn't. My first real fear that I remember being drunk was right at the end when I knew it was caving in. When I knew it was going to happen, I was going to have to stop somehow because I was going to die. And my biggest fear was I did not understand how I could be surrounded. Some of you know my story. I'm a teacher. Both my parents are alive. I have three brothers. I have a lot of friends. I played softball. I was so alone and I didn't know why. I had no idea. You know, I would push everyone away. And then I'd drink and I'd go, where's everybody? And it was just such a mess in my head of why am I so scared I'm going to die alone and I'm going to be alone. And it was all my choice, but I didn't know that, you know. And then when I got sober and, you know, when I did my fourth step and I made that column and it says in what David read, you know, fear is a corroding thread. It's everywhere. And it was. I was so scared of everything. And I didn't know it. I was afraid of losing my wife, but that wasn't going to happen when I was drinking. I was afraid of, you know, when I told you before when I was drinking, I wasn't afraid of losing money. When I got sober, I thought, you know, all my money worries are going to be gone because I went to my wife and I go, okay, now I'm sober. We're good. Let's pay some bills. She goes, my friend, you drank through one college fund. You drank through one savings. We have no money, man. And I was scared to death. What had I done? You know, coming out of this fog, what had I done? You know, I was scared to death. I'd lost my kids because I should have. I tried to, you know, not purposely, but I should have. I should have lost my parents. You know, I would never call my mom and dad after noon on the weekends because I knew they knew. They'd hear me slur. They'd hear me repeat the same story. I was such a bad son and I was scared to death that they would never love me again. So I guess one of my biggest fears was I'd lost every person on this earth who loved me. And so I think that's where I'm going to stop with the fear part on that part. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Arisa?
Thanks. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, David. Good to be with you guys. My name's Arisa, most definitely an alcoholic. The date of my last drink was October the 13th of 1993. And for that, I am truly, truly grateful. My home group is the Beacon Group in the Boston area. We meet 5 days a week at noon on Zoom, Monday nights hybrid at 8 p.m. to do a big book study, and Thursday nights free speaker meeting. Love to have you guys. Okay, so fear. So my story is totally different. I had a lot of consequences, and you know, I am the girl that, you know, if it could go wrong, it went wrong with me. You know what I mean? My first time in a bar, I get abducted and raped. You know, I mean, when, you know, I don't have small consequences. I have cataclysmic consequences. You know, my first night out drinking, I get a minor in possession. You know, like, I mean, I don't have a mild version of, you know, events. So there was, you know, and I grew up with a lot of fear. I grew up being beaten up by my father. There was a lot of abuse, you know, at home, school, everywhere. And I learned to hide. I learned to run. I learned to do a lot of those things. So when we talk about fear in AA, you know, we're at this point, it says, notice that fear is bracketed alongside, right? And under the effects mind with the resentments. So why does it keep getting bracketed? Because that third column, when I'm doing resentments, is if you have hurt or threatened any of my basic instincts, you're going to get a reaction from me, right? And that's what I began to see was so important. It's not that I resented you per se, it's what you did. And it's not even so much what you did, is how it was going to take away something that I have or not give me access to what I need. And so I can't make a choice, I get a reaction, right? So my sponsor put it this way, your family wired you, right? And you ever notice like your siblings know all your buttons because they help to install them, right? And they come and they can push your buttons, and it's without even thinking or breathing even. And if you push this button, you're going to get a certain reaction from me, and it's not going to be pretty, right? There is no pause before I do that stuff. And she said, we get to do the rewiring. We get to do the rewiring. It's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. Okay. And one of the things I really like is the image that Bill uses here, you know, that the fabric of our life was shot through with them. When I first read that, you know, probably like a lot of you, I thought about somebody, you know, taking a gun, right? But that's not actually what it's meaning. It's actually so much more interesting. When I was a kid, I grew up in Texas, and we would go to the missions, and they'd have these big old looms. And remember, when this was written, this is the sort of thing they're thinking about. Not many people, you know, are going to be thinking about the gun as much as weaving cloth, and that the threads come like this together. And then there's something called a shuttle that is literally, it shoots through back and forth. And so if the fabric of your life is shot through with it, the little shuttle is tied to a string, a thread, and that's fear. And it goes in and out of every single piece of fabric. So like Mike's shirt, that's a woven fabric, very obviously woven fabric. So up and down, up and down, up and down. And mind you, it's laced with acid, so it's eating the entire thing away. It's not a hole here and there. It is literally like creeping through every part of me. And that image, right? It really, so the way Mike was talking about it, it's the fear's there, right? It's how am I treating the fear, right? Am I drinking through the fear? Am I punching you through the fear? Am I hiding from, you know, because of the fear? So you're getting certain reactions out of me, right? And fear set in motion trains of circumstance. Now that was the big way to travel at the time. And the thing about a train is, you know, if you're on the bus and you want to get off at the next stop and you ring the little, you know, bell, you can wait until just almost when it's time to get off the bus and the bus can stop. Not so with a train, right? Trains take a long time to, and they're going to keep moving, right? It's very hard to slow them down. And that's what it's saying. It's not so much that fear is this horrible thing. It's that when you see, this is a good example, at the airport, when they park the planes and they put the blocks in front of the wheels, that's so the plane doesn't go rolling. So all you have to do is kick the block out from the train And now you've got this thing that's going to crash into everything and devastate anything in its path. And it wasn't that big a deal. The fear set in motion this other thing. And it never looks that way to me. It looks like, you know, I'm just protecting myself. Or some of Mike's examples were wonderful. You know, I don't have to be scared of losing my marriage because I've already got a girlfriend. You know, like that's the way we were, right? And misfortune, we felt we didn't deserve because I didn't do it necessarily, right? I can't see that just because I kicked this thing out from the wheel, what other people did as a result, right? And it says earlier in this chapter that we invariably find, and that means always, there's never, never an exception that I somehow am involved. But that's a beautiful promise, right? If it's me, then I don't have to wait for David to get better because you know what? He's probably not gonna, right? My husband is also David. So, you know, don't take it too personally there, but I want it to be your fault. I don't want to look at me. Fear keeps me from being honest, taking the honest appraisal. You know, my ego says I don't need to, but it's fear that's really driving the ego. I was taught that fear is the muscle of the ego. It's what, you know, really pushes things through, right? And fear will change the way I see everything. If you've ever been to the theater, like there's a whole, you know, lighting design that happens and they'll put like a green gel over the light. And all of a sudden people look a little nastier. Or if they put a rosy one over, they look nicer. And I go through life with these filters on and it's dirt and muck. And assuming malice is one of the things that I learned. And I learned it because it's protective. It's protective. If I assume you may grab me by my hair and throw me down the stairs, I will probably not end up in that circumstance because I'm not going to let you get close enough to me. And I would rather pay the price of never having relationships with people than getting hurt again. Right. And so one of my biggest things was how I assumed I knew what you were thinking. And fear drives that over and over again. Fear is the second manifestation that we're talking about in the book, right? The first one where we talk about is resentments. But if fear is really and truly a manifestation of self, right, then I see it differently. It's me. I'm a big believer that all of our emotions are God-given. They're here to help us and not to hurt us. That includes fear. Fear is healthy when it's in proportion. But if it's out of proportion, I'm going to be in trouble. A healthy fear gets me to look both ways before I cross the street, right? But if I can't right-size that fear, right? We were talking before the meeting about, you know, why we're on Zoom because of this pandemic, right? We have a healthy fear there, but we can take it to a good, an unhealthy extreme, or we can let God use it to clean our lives up and do better. And that's, I think, what we're really going to be seeing. But didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? And then we have to class it with stealing, right? And I don't think of it that way. I didn't think of fear like that. I felt like it was protecting me. I couldn't see how much it was robbing my life, that I used fear to justify why I don't have to do that, to justify why, you know, or that I shouldn't try to do things. I hide from the world, right? And the more I recognize how much fear has taken from me, right? And the other thing that fear does a lot for me is, I don't know about you, but when I came in the rooms, I was a liar. I would lie about stupid stuff. I would break out into Australian, you know, like I'm a liar. What can I say? But the thing is that I'm not lying because of, you know, like some sociopathic thing. I'm lying because I'm afraid. I'm lying because you can't see me. I'm lying because I have to be bigger than, you know, I am because you won't like me, right? So fear is the sort of thing that's going to push me into all these character defects that I'm going to see as protective. So if I'm going to uncover those and not need them, then something's going to happen. And we're going to look at that in a minute. That's all I've got. Thanks, David.
Thank you both so much. We're going to continue on page 68. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him. Does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Mike?
Yeah. So in this fourth step, I've written that column and it says fear, 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 fear. But now I got to go back and I got to see, did I really, really, really do step three? Did I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him? Because now I'm going to have to face these fears, and I couldn't do it alone, and I can't do it alone, but I have to be very certain that I'm willing to do it. And to be willing, I have to turn it over to God. I can't make those excuses anymore that, you know, Mike was Mike this, Mike that, Mike that. I have to really, really, did I do step three to the best of my ability? And the other thing I have to do is I'm going to have to always realize that there's going to be fear in this life, always. But am I going to turn it over to the care of God? And like in this pandemic, I've had discussions with my sponsor where I couldn't do it. I honestly questioned a couple times, am I willing to go to any lengths to get this? You know, I hated Zoom. I don't like Zoom. You move my cheese. You know, I couldn't do this. I teach on Zoom, but I couldn't do this on Zoom. You know, I just couldn't do it. But, you know, but he explained to me, you know, it's kind of hard when the whole world is in fear. You know, that's overwhelming. And I can't take that on myself. I can't. And there were times I did during this pandemic. I was scared of everybody being scared. And that shouldn't be on my shoulders. You know, I can't handle that. I can't do that. I did that when I drank. The whole world was on my shoulders. I was going to fix everything. Everything was running through my head, and I was going to take care of all of it. And I stepped back into that a little bit during this pandemic. Everybody's scared, and I'm going to fix everybody, and I'm going to be worried about everybody, and I can't do. And I really, really had to have some deep talks with my higher power. In that second paragraph, you know, where all men of faith have courage, and we demonstrate it through us. I talked in the first time I talked about being lonely. To me, that was a lonely, lonely space at the beginning. Do I really have this faith? Are you guys really, really, do you believe all this stuff that you're saying and telling me and teaching me and trying to get me to do? And you know what happens when you're new? Hope, you know, what I did was just listen for a long time, didn't believe a lot of it. And then finally, through this whole process of AA, you know, when I go to meetings and I hear other people describe their faith, I pick up pieces of that. I'm like, wow, that works for them. They believe that. It's their higher power. It's not mine. But they are not running this show by themselves anymore. I believe that. When I call my sponsor and he tells me, Mike, trust in me for a little bit until you trust in this higher power. And I'm like, okay, I will for a little bit. And then he's like, let's do some work, man. Let's say some simple prayers. And, you know, I've had two sponsors and it's worked for them. Why am I fighting it? You know, believe them. And I started to. And then there's so many examples in the big book, you know, but if I read my big book, it's there. And I read it with a sponsor and it's there. You know, 80 years ago, however many years ago, these men who at first, when I read the book, I just laughed at, I have nothing in common with them. But they have a faith and a belief again in a power greater than themselves that cured them of this, you know? And I look around sometimes when I question it and I go, you know what? I don't have the obsession to drink anymore. That's a miracle. And that happened because of faith. It just did. You know, I could hardly, my career is talking to people, and I got here and I couldn't talk to anybody and I was scared to death. And now I can talk to people and I can give them what was given to me because I have a faith in this, that it works. It does work. And when I turn it over to a higher power and I'm willing to face those fears and I believe in all the things, this whole Encompass program, then I'm safe. I feel safe. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Mike. Arisa.
Thank you. So I didn't share much on the second paragraph. I want to go through, and there are a lot of different ways that people write fear inventories, and I'm aware of that. And I've done a bunch of different ones in the past. I want to share with you how I do it today, because I try my best to stick with exactly what the book is doing. The first thing it says is we reviewed our fears thoroughly, put them on paper. So it's, you know, make a list, name that fear, right? You know, name the fear. And then the next thing it says, we asked ourselves why we had them. And it was important to me to realize that some of them, you know, were not necessarily grounded in a whole lot, but that it was important for me to know why I have these fears. Like, I have a healthy fear of, you know, people hurting me. That's reasonable, actually, considering where I grew up. You know, I had a fear that came up in my sobriety around dogs, because my son was severely allergic to dogs, right? And the world had kind of gone to this place where up here in Boston, like, people were letting their dogs run through the parks off leashes all of a sudden, very freely, you know. And when I say he had an allergy, I mean anaphylaxis, you know. So I suddenly had a lot of fear around dogs, right? So why do I have this fear? Those are fears that are here to help me, right? And so understanding that if I don't get that treated with God, that fear cannot be made smaller. It cannot be made smaller. So it says then, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And I was taught to really look at, okay, so how are you trying to manage this fear, the fear of dogs? You know, like, the problem that I'm having is that, yes, I have the EpiPen, okay? But when somebody's dog runs towards me and my little boy, right, I can pick him up, and we got jumped on a few times, but I want you to keep your dogs on leashes. And I am trying to only go to the park during the hours, you know, the right hours. And then, you know, we're in the gate and somebody brings the dog into the playground, and, you know, when there are no dogs allowed, but there they are, right? And no matter what I do, I can't make you behave as much as I'm trying, right? And you know, with, like, my dad, my parents, like, I can hide for as long as I can, but sooner or later, you know, everything breaks down and I end up in this position yet again. So self is good as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. It can't really solve my problem. So it says, then there's a better way, right? We're on a different basis. This third step that I did, this is a different basis, a foundation. And that foundation is trusting and relying upon God. And my belief, so the third step is, you know, really about belief, right? We came to believe in step two and step three. You know, I'm making this decision, right? Because I believe that you believe, and I make this decision, I'm going to try it. And trust is earned. And this is how we begin to trust God. This is, you know, experiential. I give you a little bit, and if you do okay with it, I'll give you a little bit more, right? I like to say, like, I learned to trust God on a layaway plan, right? It's like, so that's what we're doing here, right? So if I am now on this basis of trusting and relying upon God, how do I do that? What is, if we say all the time, AA is a practical program of action, what's the action? Okay, great, I'm on a different basis, but that doesn't help me. There are still dogs running around the park. What do I do? Well, here's the thing. Here's what it says. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. So Bill's done the switcheroo on us. Get a God, any God. Now, by the way, he's got to be, you know, this, and he's got to be that. And in this case, it's infinite, right? God's got to be infinite. Okay, so then it says, we are in the world to play the role he assigns. But how do I play the role? Like, remember the theater. So we've looked at some of our stage characters in The Resentments, right? You know, I mean, we've all got them. We've got, you know, I've got Xena the Warrior, right? You guys have got Rambo or something like that. You know, I mean, there's Princess Leia to, you know, whatever, right? We've all got these stage characters, but that's not what we're talking about here. Now I need to put those stage characters away and find out what is the role that God's assigning me in this scenario with the dog, with the little boy. What's the role? And the role is mother. The role is mother. And mothers are not dog catchers. Mothers are not, you know, police officers that write people tickets. You know, mothers are not, like, there are a lot of other roles that, you know, I'm not a park ranger, right? I'm not the schoolyard monitor. I'm none of these things, right? I am mom. And when I get right-sized about that, you know, I need to have a contingency plan. I need to make sure that I have the EpiPen, right? But how do I know these things? Because it says right after it, I'm in the world to play the role that he assigns. Don't step out of your role, right? Don't start playing dog catcher or police officer. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us. So if I know the role, what do I do? I like to give the example, if the role is nurse, what do nurses do? They take your temperature, they give, you know, medication, they check your blood pressure, that sort of thing, right? What do mothers do? And that's what I'm saying. I need to make sure we pack the EpiPen. I need to make sure I'm not at the park during off-leash hours. I need to, right? And I need to be willing to speak to people, but I do not need to be berating them. I don't need to threaten them in any way, shape, or form, right? So that's what if I know the role, now I know what I do. And this beautiful promise is I can get it wrong. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity, okay? So I can get the answer wrong. Maybe there's a better park I should have gone to that where, you know, nobody ever goes with their dogs, but, you know, but if I do this in good faith, trying my best, then the promise is not that nothing bad will happen. It's not, it is not that nothing bad will happen. It is that I will be able to handle it. I will be able to show up for the problem. And later on in our book on page 133, back in the family afterwards, it says that, you know, we make our own misery. God doesn't, right? A problem plus me is misery. A problem plus God is an opportunity. And that's what I get to see here, right? And then we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our creator. That's the attitude I need to take. I need to be saying, you know what? Okay, God, I don't like it, but I'm going to learn to like it. You know, when things aren't going my way, I'm having a problem with the third step because the third step says it ain't my life anymore. Okay, God, what have you got for me? I'm going to show up for it. This is not how I want it to be, but okay, it must be, there must be a way to make it good because you are asking me to show up for this, right? So it is not a weak thing. It is my strength. And the one of these spiritual gains, all men of faith have courage, right? I find my courage there. They trust their God. This is, like I said, this is how we're building trust. And this prayer, this fear prayer, we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. And that's the last thing that I use in, for my fear inventory is be. Be is different than do. Do is, you know, carry the EpiPen, check the park hours, right? All of those things. Be is the attitude. And the old timers that I got sober with said the other meaning of AA was attitude adjustment. So what does God need me to be? Courageous, proactive, trusting, open, kind, loving, understanding, right? But there, it's the attitude I take into my life. And then I get to, I love Bill. I just love Bill. It's like at once, right now, immediately, we commence, which is only begin, to outgrow, which takes a long time. Right. But it's, I get in the process. I outgrow fear. It doesn't go away. Right. But the fears don't fit anymore. I have something more now. right? And that's what I'm really, really trying to be different. And that is how we convert our shortcomings into these assets, right? My fears begin to be blessings. They keep me from getting hit by the bus by not checking both ways. And I can be grateful for the fear. And I was told also to thank God for exactly where I am and ask God to let me learn all the lessons that are here, right? Because that's how we outgrow them. We don't, just like character defects, we don't work on them. We have to embrace them and know this is who I am and that, God takes them away in God's, but I have to be willing to be small enough to say, yeah, I got it. I do have this. Show me what to do and I'll sign up for service today. That's all I got. Thanks, Dave.
Oh, thank you both. We're going to continue on page 68. I think I'm going to do two paragraphs because they're related and we can cover a little ground here. We're going to continue on page 68. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiters of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? And on page 69, we reviewed our conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Mikey.
Hey, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. This is, sex. Here we go. Part of this is talking about the physical act of sex, and that is where I'm going to sound like the biggest ass again, because when I was drinking, that was it. It is hard to say this now. I did not care. I had no emotional tie to any of it. And that's tough to say. I wasn't raised that way. I wasn't brought up that way. I didn't learn it that way. But when I poured that drink into my body, Mr. Inhibitions left, Mr. Conscience left, Mr. Everything just left. Are you going to make me feel good? And that's terrible to say, but it's the truth. And, that's how I ran around and did things. Now, I'm going to tell you that I've learned way more in Alcoholics Anonymous than how to stop drinking. I've learned how to be a father and a man and a grown-up. And I will tell you this. I was talking to some people before the meeting. I have a 17-year-old son, right? And I also have two grown daughters. One's 30, one's 26. So that's my kids. So I have an alcoholic in training. And not really. He's not an alcoholic in training. But at 17, he knows everything. The world circles around him. I can't tell him a thing, except we've had this talk. And I was so happy to have the talk with him because I didn't learn this till I was 50. And it's a creepy talk. It's a weird talk. Because I do say, dude, it feels good. It's great. But there's emotions tied to this that, I know you're probably going to do it or doing it, but you have to be ready for some other things that I don't think you're ready for. And it took me, like I said, till I was 50 to learn that sex means doing something for somebody else that you don't want to do. Like, the dishes are piled up in the sink and she comes home from working all day. Why don't I just do the dishes? Make that easier for her. Hold her hand. hug her when she just needs a hug. Let me tell you what I did in the middle of all of my, you know, going through this stuff. My sponsor's here and he's right there. He's David. So one time I was having trouble at home. I said, David, what do I do? And he said, every day for the next week, you roll over and you look Kristen right in the face and you say, what can I do for you today? And I did that for 7 days, man. And she was the happiest person on earth. And on day 8, I got out of bed and she goes, hold on. Didn't David tell you to ask me something today? You know, and I was like, oh yeah. What can I do for you today? You know, it took a lot of learning. It took a lot. I am not like, we're getting ready to be empty nesters, you know, and sitting together on the couch watching creeps me out. I'm like, why are we doing that? Because that's what you do when you're a unit together, when you love someone. And I learned that in AA, and that has nothing to do with not stop drinking, but it's something I learned as a man. Now, here's the other part in the next page, where it's, where was I selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate, and who did I hurt? So when I was going through that list in the sex inventory, I read all that stuff. And you know what? I had to go make amends on my sex inventory to my friend. I didn't have sex with my friend, but I sure asked them to lie for me to say, I was here, wasn't I? Or I was there, wasn't I? When I really wasn't. You know, I had to make amends as best I could to my adult children who heard it. They knew. They heard the fights. They heard, and they, you know, and that's a hard thing also to, you know, when I'm explaining it to my son, I said, how would you like your sister? I didn't treat women like I would like my daughters to. That's a hard pill to swallow. And I had to make amends for that because that's not how I treated people. I was awful. I had to make amends to certain partners because there was reasons I used sex. Ooh, big man had a lot of sex. So, woo, look at him. Revenge. I was the most, I would twist that shit, excuse me, on my wife so bad. She was doing nothing, but I would throw it at her. You're cheating on me. You're doing this. You've done this to me. And it was so far from the truth, but it was all because of my own fear and my own insecurities and my own getting caught and my own just life being a shambles. And also, you know, it says in here, and I think it might be in the next part, but I'll just jump ahead real fast and I'll be done. I made amends to my wife without creating harm. There was enough knowledge there to know what had happened. And I made amends for that. But you know what? I'm where I'm supposed to be every second now. I am, you know, she asked to see my phone here. You know, I do what I'm supposed to. I am not afraid to walk up to a woman and introduce her to my wife. I'm not, if I know her, you know, I'm not, I'm just because I am comfortable in my skin with my wife and I love my wife. And that took a lot of learning. I will tell you this one funny story and I'll be done. When I first got sober, I left Friday night and I was walking down Colley Avenue and my head was down and I was dying. And she drove by in a car and I didn't see her. She goes, hey baby, what are you doing? I'm like, oh God, I am not looking up. I am not looking at any girls. I am not doing any of this. And I got home and she said, good boy, good boy. And I'm like, please don't do it. Stop, Ted. Stop it. Stop. I'm dying right now. Leave me alone. But you know, there's funny parts of it too. So I'm going to stop right there. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Okay. I'm going to go a little bit on the technical side again for you. First thing I'm going to say is, are there any other grease monkeys out there? Or am I the only one? I'm a grease monkey. Okay. So I grew up turning wrenches and fixing cars with my dad. And for those of you who don't really know what an overhauling is, I think it's important to understand. So, you know, these days, like very few people work on their own cars anymore. But when, you know, this book was written, people didn't get new cars all the time. And so there's a difference between going in and getting a tune-up, which is like new spark plugs or whatever, and an oil change, maybe your air filter gets changed, and an overhauling. And what an overhauling is when you get a winch, not that kind, and you hook it onto the engine and you pull it up out of the car and you set it over here. And then you take the entire, and yes, I've done this, you take the entire thing apart and you inspect every little piece. You put in new gaskets and anything that isn't perfect, you fix it or you get a new one and you reassemble it and you put it back down into the car and you hook it up again. So today we would call it like factory recertified or something like that. But, you know, it's essentially a new car. That's the idea. And many of us, not all, but many of us need an overhauling there. This is not a cursory look. This is, hey guys, something is rotten in there. Okay. What's going on? We don't know where it is. Look at everything. Assume something could be wrong with every piece of this, right? That's an overhauling. And you have to have a really open mind to do that. Okay. So when I look at this, what can we all have sex problems? How reassuring was that? Okay. We'd hardly be human otherwise. What can we do about them? What is there to be done? You know, human nature, this is the easiest place to get like sparks flying. Okay. It's just way too easy. So when it says I reviewed my own conduct, it doesn't say I need to, you know, necessarily do every single one ever, but it's all about my conduct. Okay. And so if I know the people, you know, and even if it's, you know, one night stand number one and one night stand number 47, right? And you know, a lot of these can be lumped together, right? Because I'm looking for my conduct, right? And I'm asking myself first these questions. Where was I selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, right? And I don't know about you, but inconsiderate is one of the hardest ones for me, because that I began to realize was it's... You know, self-centeredness is like the flip side of inconsideration. You know, I'm only thinking about me. That's self-centered. Inconsiderate is I have mowed you down and I didn't notice, right? Was there a speed bump there, right? That's how much, like, I'm not thinking about you at all. It never crosses my mind how this is going to affect you, right? It asks these questions and then it says, whom had we hurt? And what I've seen over the years is that people have a tendency to think about their relationships and go, well, I only hurt David. The rest of them, I didn't really hurt. No problem. Then I go and I ask, where was I selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? And you skip over that. Whom did we hurt? And Mike, you can tell he did it the right way because he figured out, I owe amends to my friends. Because if you do it in the right order, okay, all of a sudden, who got hurt is after you're already assessing this relationship. How about his wife, right? How about my boyfriend's mother, right? Who's how about my friends that I'm calling and crying and they're like, you really should leave him, that I don't, you know, because I don't really want to leave him. I just want to puke on somebody so I can stay, right? Those are the kind of things that come out of this when you do these questions in the right order, right? Did we unjustifiably? What does that mean? It means that there must be justifiable stuff too. Just unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness. So they're the people that you end up with. They're jealous. They're jealous because you said thank you to the postman, right? I'm not getting involved with the postman, okay? You know, not interested in the, all I said was thank you for the mail. And you've got like the storm coming at you. That is justifiable. Their jealousy, I am justified in my actions of being polite to the police officer. And I say this because a lot of women are in the scenario where, you know, they get a lot because, you know, some guy's looking at him, at looking at her or whatever. And that's not my responsibility. If you are a super jealous person, that's not what we're talking about here. We are talking about, am I flirting with David? Wink, wink, all that, so that my husband, David, goes, who's he, you know, because I'm trying to get my husband to pay me attention. That's unjustifiable. That's what we're talking about here. Where did I try to make you jealous? You know, and what is the suspicion and the bitterness? And by the way, that's with everybody I just made the list of. That's his parents, my friends, you know, all these. Because how am I going to make amends if I didn't actually find out what did I do to them? But here's the great part. And I know in AA, a lot of people like to write sex ideals. That's fine. Not saying you can't. But, you know, it's not really the, you know, single white female searching for, you know, like, that's not what we're talking about. Like, he's got to be tall, dark, and handsome, or, you know. And then it's gotten a little bit better when people are like, well, what are you taking to the party? No, no. What the book is actually saying, I'm not saying those aren't fine things to do. They're fine. They're fine. But what the book says to do, where Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? That's the ideal. What should I have done instead? And you know, I hear a lot of stuff in the rooms. One of them that I don't like, and one of them is don't should on yourselves. Should is in the big book all over the place. I love should. You know why? Because should is an ideal. Should is an ideal. It does not say what could I have done instead. Could means at the time I had the ability to do something different. This is, you know, I'm driving to my daughter's school and I don't know where the turn is and I miss it. But the next time I remember there's McDonald's right before, so I won't miss it a second time. I should have turned right after the McDonald's. That's all it is. So that if I'm in a similar situation ever again, I will know what I can do differently. That is the sane and sound ideal, right? That's what I'm trying to get to. Because if I had no coping skills, I had no modeling, I had no idea how to do any of this stuff, right? But I do know what didn't work. And I can look back and say, if I had known then what I know now, if I had had a relationship with a higher power, if I had had sponsorship, if I had had principles in my life, I could have maybe done something different. And that's what a should is. Now on our nightly review, it says, what could we have done? Because now I do have, right, some principles to live by, I have some experience. And that's asking me, where is the difference between what you had the ability to do and what you actually did? But here, that's not what this is. This is not a shaming exercise. This is, let's help you never have to make these same mistakes in time, right? And that's why it's you know, a sane and sound. And what soundness of mind is, you know, if you've ever hung a painting on the wall, I'm an artist, I make big paintings, you can see one of them behind me. And if you hang a painting that size on the wall without making sure where you're putting the nail in, it's going to fall. And so the old way of doing it is you would tap, and it'll sound one way if it's solid and another way if it's hollow, right? Soundness of mind. Soundness means it's solid. You know that when you anchor something in, it will hold. That's what I'm trying to do. Something that is going to stand the test of time. And that's where I'm trying to go. We ask God, this is the sex prayer, right? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them, right? We remember that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. And that was really, really important for me. You know, I don't generally get in trouble when I compromise your principles. It's when I compromise mine, right? That's when I can't look myself in the eye. That's when I don't want to be here anymore. I need to know that I really am trying to be the person that I believe my higher power wants me to be, right? That and the other last thing I want to say is that it's, we haven't gotten there, I know, but I'm going to say this anyway. It's only in this part of the inventory that Bill ever mentions making amends. And it was really important to me that I did that. My sponsor sent me out to make the amends to my exes. And it really breaks my heart that so many people don't do that. And I got to tell you, for any of you guys who think, you know, well, you know, the best thing I can do is get out of her life. I had one of those. And I had a newborn baby when all of a sudden I heard from this guy, right? And I'd made amends to him when I got sober. And then all these years later, this guy reaches out and makes amends to me. And I got to tell you, it still meant something, even though I was over a decade sober. You know, because when somebody walks across you and they just treat you like garbage, it's really nice to know that they noticed. And that for me was what, you know, I don't want to be that inconsiderate person anymore. So if somebody's ever told you don't make those, check it out again, you know, because I will say I'm glad that I got to do that. And I'm really glad that somebody did some of those the other direction too. So I see that we're getting to the top of the hour. So I will put a plug in it. Thanks a lot. Thanks for letting me be here. Good night.
Oh, thank you both so much. We really got to move to a 90-minute format. That was amazing. Just wonderful. And that will conclude the sharing portion this evening. Thanks, Arisa and Mike. Again, everybody will get the opportunity to thank them after we pray. I'm going to throw the seventh tradition link out here again. And the seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? You have the ability to unmute. Hearing none, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to any one of us. If you're shy, you can also send an email to info@simpleactions.net. In closing, we thank Mike and Arisa again. That was awesome. And let's see, who have I got? Debbie D. Debbie D, you want to read the last three paragraphs on page 164, please?
I'd love to. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
A vision for you, big book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and you until then. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank everybody who participated tonight. Let's virtually circle up. I'm a big fan of a staticky, confusing version of the Lord's Prayer. Feel free to unmute. We'll have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father.
Father, who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come,
thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread,
and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive
those who trespass against us.
Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen. Woohoo! That was awesome. Thank you guys
Mike.
So much.
Thanks, Arisa.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, y'all. So really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Thanks
for sharing. Thanks, God bless you both.
Love you, big boy.
Thanks, Dave.